I'm Anthony Pastore, and welcome to UBS On Air. While many of us are sheltering in place throughout the coronavirus epidemic, it's very easy to get caught up in binge-watching a TV show, finding activities to occupy your kids, video chatting with friends and family, and, of course, swiping through social media. So while you're there, you probably start reading the myriad articles and blogs about coronavirus, and you start second-guessing everything you think you know about the virus and its symptoms and the ways to protect yourself and your loved ones. So trust me when I say I speak from experience. Today, we are going to debunk those misconceptions and get to the real facts at hand. I'm lucky to have with me again my guest for this podcast, Dr. Suzanne Murray, Program Director for the Smithsonian's Global Health Program and a board-certified zoo veterinarian at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. In her role, Suzanne has done some incredible work researching coronaviruses and their spread from animals to humans. Suzanne is also a UBS Global Visionary. Today is Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. Dr. Murray, I'm so excited to have you join me again. I know you were on with us a couple of weeks back, really almost at the start of this whole situation that we're currently in right now. It's great to have you back. Thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to chat with me today.
Anthony, thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Suzanne, before we dive into the COVID-19 latest news, I thought maybe you could provide a quick overview on what it means to be a UBS Global Visionary so our audience is familiar.
That's a great question as well, so thank you for asking. It's really a great honor for me to be able to work with UBS because not many banks really take investing in civic responsibilities and communities as seriously as you guys do. Not only is it important for us in the world now recognizing that we're all connected and we all have to do things to help each other out, I think the younger generation in general, and more specifically, is really working on being invested in socially responsible organizations. And it's a great opportunity for us to listen, hear that, and support it. And I'm very happy to have a platform in which to share all the great work our team does. So thank you to UBS, to you and UBS for that.
Of course. And we thank you so much for taking time out of your I'm sure it's a crazy schedule that you have these days with so much going on to be with us. So you did speak with us, I guess it was about a month ago now, about the virus, and it was really, as I said, the early stages. It was just starting to emerge. To better understand how we've come to where we are today, how did this coronavirus likely begin? And I know it is some speculation, but what do we know?
There is so much we know about coronavirus now, at the COVID-19, and we learn more with each passing week, and we'll be learning a lot more over the next couple of months as well. What we do know is that research has shown that 75% of emerging infectious diseases jump from animals, wildlife in particular, into the human population, and the viral families that we need to be really worried about, influenza, coronaviruses, and paramyxoviruses in particular, are something that can be carried by bats, primates, and rodents, and we really need to look at those junctures in which people come into contact with wildlife. We also know that these epidemics are coming more and more frequently because there's a number of things that cause the spillover of these viruses, so we've been looking at that. And Anthony, we've talked a bunch of times, and one of the first times, maybe even closer to 6 weeks ago, we were thinking, wow, this caught everybody so much by surprise. And my response was, but it didn't. It caught the markets by surprise and a lot of other different, and a lot of different economies and a lot of different institutions. But the medical institutions and the folks doing research in this field have been saying for quite a while, these epidemics are coming. It's a socially responsible thing to do to save lives, to get ahead of it, and it's fiscally responsible. It costs a lot less money to prevent an outbreak than it does to try and diagnose, treat, and contain, as we're seeing now.
Right.
So one of the places we landed at one of those conversations was, you know, we do think of economies as global. They're very interconnected. It's the time for us to think of health in the same way. So at that point, we knew that the coronavirus was erupting and it was being spread by community, so that means person to person. And we also thought it was very likely that it came from a bat, because we knew that a number of the viruses that our teams had found previously in China in bats were coronaviruses. So we had some thought that that's probably where it was coming from. Some of the things we didn't know was that just how infectious it would be and how it is, and then also that so many people could carry it asymptomatically. And that's really an issue, that it's really being spread quickly by folks that aren't even aware that they're ill. Mm-hmm. So we're learning a lot more about transmission and clinical signs. And now we're going to need to learn a lot about treatment and containment.
Right. Then I have questions about that for you as well. Did you and other experts in the field know that this type of pandemic would be coming?
We didn't know that a pandemic was coming. We knew that everything was in place for repeated epidemics to be coming, meaning we knew that spillovers continue to happen from wildlife to humans. And we knew our larger team, USAID funded PREDICT program that was led out of UC Davis, had identified over 1,000 new viruses over the last 10 years. And then we have teams of virologists look at those 1,000 viruses and say, are they all bad actors or are there some we really need to be concerned about? And we also have teams of phylogenetic people who look at which are the species that carry viruses that we need to be concerned about. And we have teams of modelers that say, what are the areas in the world that in which the next virus is likely to come from? So we've known a number of things. We've known some of the areas of concern, and we've known some of the animals that would carry deadly viruses, and we knew that it was likely to be one of several families of viruses. At the same time, with any kind of modeling, it's as good as the information you put in. So the more data we can collect, the more accurate our models would be. Very much like the weather, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, like 20 years ago, we weren't able to tell when a tornado's coming. We've gathered, we've invested, we've put a lot of energy into that, and now we can predict pretty well some of the storms that are on their way. We need to be doing the same thing with health as well.
How do you, so I'm assuming then you're probably learning a lot, and you and every other medical professional is learning a lot as this pandemic continues, but how do you see the COVID-19 virus specifically differing from some of the past outbreaks that you've experienced in your career?
Viruses act so differently. So for instance, something like Ebola is a very deadly virus, and it kills people quickly before they really have much time to be in touch with others. So they don't have, it's not as likely to spread. Something like another coronavirus, a very famous one, MERS, is something that had a very high case fatality rate. So a lot of people became ill more quickly and unfortunately died, but fortunately, before they had a chance to spread it. What we're seeing more with COVID-19 is that it has a lower case fatality rate, which means that people can be walking around with it for quite a while, with it not necessarily feeling all that sick and spreading it. I think the other thing for us to be concerned about, we're, you know, all very concerned about becoming ill and spreading it. We need to keep in mind that over the next 10 years, by far the majority of us will have been exposed, and by far the majority of us will have mild to moderate symptoms. So the issue so much right now isn't will we all get it, but let's try and not get it now, because the emergency rooms and the healthcare workers are really working around the clock and they're being overrun by the critical care patients. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea of social distancing is not so much keeping us from ever getting the virus, but let's just try and, you probably heard the term flatten the curve. So we spread out the length of time that it takes for people to get exposed.
Right. And first of all, let me just say that the medical professionals throughout the world, and especially here in the U.S. where we're seeing cases on the rise and probably will for the next couple of weeks, they deserve so much thanks and praise for everything that they're doing and putting themselves on the front lines to try and help us. So, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you then also, do you expect these... This is probably a question you get a lot. Do you expect these types of outbreaks to continue in the future? Is there something that we should be thinking about maybe to try and prevent this? Are we learning right now what we could do for future outbreaks if there are any?
We do expect these outbreaks to keep coming. We don't know if they're going to be as serious and widespread and actually turn into a pandemic. So we don't know if they're going to be as bad as this one, but we do expect these spillovers to keep coming. There's a lot that we can do to prevent. And there's a lot we've been doing to lay the groundwork to mitigate the effects of a virus like this. In the last 10 years, we've built and we've trained folk, a lot of folks internationally as the One Health workforce to be in the front line and prepare for recognizing and responding to such viruses. We've worked with laboratories to build capacity so laboratories would be able to diagnose very quickly, and communication networks so people can also transfer information very quickly. What I shudder to think about is, what would this outbreak look like if all of that had not been in place? It would have been much, much worse. So the time right now, as you just said, is really for us to concentrate on saving people's lives. It's the most important thing now in protecting our healthcare workers. But when we are able to slow down, it behooves us all to think into the future and say, how can we invest in having this not happen again? And a lot of the CDC has done such a tremendous job taking care of human lives. What's often missing in this equation is the veterinary component or wildlife health surveillance. And that is something that if we want to get ahead of this next outbreak and we want to find out what viruses are there, that's really the thing for us to be spending some time on.
How do we break this cycle then, Suzanne? I know that you've been involved in many initiatives that are aimed at curbing the spread of diseases from animals to humans. Maybe you can elaborate on that type of work and how these outbreaks can be mitigated in the future.
Yeah, certainly there are definitely ways to mitigate such outbreaks in the future. So as our larger team and this one terrific project is just coming to a close, it's at the end of its funding cycle, but we've worked as a partnership with five other organizations in 30 countries to identify hotspots or places that are most likely to have viral spillover. And then we're also working to prioritize the risk. So our surveillance is risk-based. We're also developing systems so we can do both human and animal health surveillance in those in real time in those countries where we think the risk is the greatest. So some of the things that we can do and continue to do in the future is is look to support these sorts of organizations and programs that are doing this. As you and I have talked about before, some of our teams in Asia and Africa, we are just as the funding cycle ends, we're letting them go. And as we looked for avenues to continue to fund their laboratories and their salaries in the future, this is not the time for us to be the world to be leaning out of supporting our laboratories internationally. We need to find ways of leaning in and really support, continuing to support the folks in the field, in the communities that are most at risk. So we've learned a lot about some of the risk factors. We're sharing that. We're doing community outreach in a number of different countries, 30 different countries, to make sure that the communities who are most at risk are the ones who are educated and best able to contribute to stopping the next outbreak. But, you know, you can't do it alone. No one can do everything, but everyone can do something. This is a great example of how we're all connected, and our health all depends on each other. Mm-hmm. And it's all of our responsibilities to step up, whether it's large or small. We all have a responsibility to help each other out and prevent this from happening again.
Yeah, hear, hear. You know, another hotly debated question I'm sure that people are talking about, I've certainly talked about it, is could the United States and other countries around the world have been better prepared for this particular situation?
Well, it's always easy to do 20/20 hindsight and say, of course, we could have been better prepared. I also think we could have been worse prepared. I give a lot of credit to USAID 10 years ago for having the foresight to having developed this emerging pandemic threats program, because they knew back then this was going to be an issue and let's start building that capacity. So without that, we would have been much, much worse off. Do we wish that funding streams are continued or expanded and more countries were involved in that? Absolutely. And hopefully more organizations and even private folks will get more involved in supporting these ventures. So, yes, we could have been better prepared. We could have been worse prepared. Hopefully this is a giant wake-up call, and we'll have more and more people involved, and again, supporting the continuum of life. You know, wildlife, domestic animals, humans, we're all interrelated, interconnected. And one of the nice things I share a lot as a wildlife veterinarian, we get to, as we're working to save a rhino or an elephant, it's the same needles and syringes for the folks that we're training to save endangered animals' lives or human lives. That's an incredible honor to be able to work on a project where we're saving human lives. So, again, thank you for UBS for supporting us.
Thank you, Suzanne. Before we get to our lightning round, where for our listeners' sake, as I mentioned in the intro, there is a lot of misconception out there related to coronavirus, COVID-19, and I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions in a sort of a lightning round. But before I get to that, we just saw today, as I was looking at the news, that experts are expecting that the apex of the virus outbreak in the United States may not be anywhere from the next 7 to 30 days. Is that right? What's the information that you have as far as when we'll see the apex and how you predict the outbreak will maybe play out over the next couple of weeks into months?
I think the information we're getting from CDC and NIH in particular tend to be very reasonable and accurate. Anthony Fauci, in my mind, provides a very stable and reasonable approach. It is going to take a while, but we also are dampening the curve. So if we don't overwhelm our hospitals, the majority of us, over 80%, are going to experience minimal health risk. So I think that's one of the things we have to keep in mind. It's not the time to hoard or to panic. And yes, it is going to, the first time we see a novel virus, it is going to take a while to spread throughout the community. And it's likely to come back again next year. But folks are working hard on developing treatments, vaccines. And increasingly, countries are working closer together. So I think I have a lot of hope for our future. So to answer your question, I think it definitely sounds reasonable that the apex will be coming in the next few weeks. But with that, we're also seeing a lot of people who are surviving and developing sort of that herd immunity. So people are getting infected and surviving. People are coming out of the hospital. And yes, this is obviously a big health scare for everyone, and we should take it seriously. But I think the idea of staying calm and doing our best with social distancing, and social distancing will, in the end, it's going to put off the peak a little bit. So the fact that we haven't hit peak yet is suggesting that some of what we're doing is working.
Right, and I was just going to ask you that. Do you see social distancing as working right now?
I think that without social distancing, a lot of people would have been sick much more quickly, especially if you think that for the first week or two, people could be walking around, transmitting virus unknowingly. Yeah, so from my perspective, I think social distancing tends to be very effective. I look out the window, there's no one on the streets, and if you go to the grocery store, I think people are listening, and as people are listening and taking the advice seriously, I do think it's working.
Great, that's good to hear from you, and you are the expert in this situation, so I appreciate your honesty there. So okay, so let's get to the lightning round, Suzanne. I think this this is really important to me and to my friends and family and my colleagues who have lots and lots of questions. So first one, which has received quite a bit of debate, is about wearing masks. Obviously, outside of people who are medical professionals, they should all be wearing masks, of course. But should people like you and me who go to the grocery store to pick up a couple things or take a walk outside, should I wear a mask?
That's a good question, because the guidance on that has changed. Typically, masks are for the people who are better at preventing an ill person from spreading an illness as opposed to preventing someone from getting it. However, in this situation with something that can be transmitted so easily, the guidance has recently changed to, yes, people should be wearing masks, anything that we can do to prevent inhaling any of these droplets would be helpful. So the guidance has changed from we don't need it to it could be helpful.
Right. Do we need N95 masks? Or I've heard things where you can actually take cotton T-shirt materials, double it up, and use that, and it's as effective.
Yeah, the N95 masks should be reserved for hospital workers and healthcare workers. The average person on the street would not need an N95 mask, especially if they're practicing social distancing.
Great, terrific. Okay, next statement is only elderly people can get sick from COVID-19.
Not accurate. What we're seeing is actually a lot of younger folks now are becoming ill. A lot of people who are getting seriously ill are those that have secondary or pre-existing conditions. But unfortunately, we're seeing a lot of folks between 20 and 45 that have become ill.
Okay, next question is the period that you are contagious. So if I contract the virus and my symptoms go away after 14 days or so, automatically I'm not contagious anymore. What's the period of contagious?
That is one of the things that we are still finding out, and we have a lot of experts who are working on that. While you still have a virus in your body, theoretically, you are still contagious, and while your symptoms might be gone by 14 days, if you still have a virus in your body, you're still considered infectious. So, yes, the infectious period is thought to go longer than 14 days.
Okay. Taking ibuprofen is dangerous if I have COVID-19. True or false?
False.
Okay. Is there any medication that I, so if I am officially given the diagnosis that I have COVID-19, is there any medication I can take or should take to help alleviate some of the symptoms?
The first thing to do is contact your medical professional and have that person give you advice. So there aren't proven, there's lots of theories about, oh, try this or try that. Don't take anything without your over-the-counter medicines without speaking to a professional.
Great. Thanks, Suzanne. You mentioned this before, but if I've had it, do I automatically develop a natural immunity to COVID-19?
We suspect that people will develop a natural immunity, but a lot of that will be finding out again in the future. Some of these viruses can mutate, in which case, depending on how much they change up their genetic profile and mutate, theoretically, you could get a different strain in the future. But at this point, people think that you will develop at least a short-term immunity.
Okay. How about the mutation rate then, Dr. Murray? Is it different than other viruses? Is it less than or more than?
This is one of the things that we'll also be learning in retrospect. There's different types of viruses, DNA viruses and RNA viruses. RNA is the coronavirus is an RNA virus similar to influenza viruses, so they tend to mutate more rapidly than other viruses, but we don't have evidence of that yet, confirmed evidence of that yet with COVID.
Okay, great. And the last question I have for you is about a vaccination, and there's been some speculation that certain pharmaceutical companies might have something to test or actually be given to the public by the fall. Any information there?
Fall seems a little bit early. I know that several companies have developed a vaccine, but before it's available to the public, clearly it would have to go through clinical trials. One of the reasons for this is that if you have a healthy person, before you inject something like a vaccine into them, you need to be very sure that that vaccine is safe. So that's one of the things the medical community takes very seriously. So all those vaccines may have been developed so far or in the testing phase. I can't imagine that they'd be ready for distribution by the fall.
Okay. Thank you.
We can always hope, and you never know.
Right, right. I guess we'll all be paying really close attention to the information that comes out from the pharmaceutical companies. Dr. Murray, thank you so, so much. Before I let you go, what would you tell our audience as something really important as a takeaway today, something they should know about COVID-19 or anything that you want to share with us?
The important things for me in this conversation are a little bit we started in the beginning. There's all things everybody can do something to help. One of the things I really appreciate about UBS is having a civic-minded organization, being a civic-minded organization that we want to do things to help the communities and have this Global Visionaries program. And also in terms of keeping everybody healthy and happy. Listen to the CDC and NIH. Wash your hands, practice social distancing, and don't panic. We will get through this. People are following advice. The curve is getting flattened. We're getting there.
Excellent. Dr. Murray, thank you so, so much.
Optimism.
Yeah, you know what? And that's such a really nice way to end our conversation with a little bit of a bright spot on the horizon. I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Anthony. Nice speaking with you.
My pleasure. And thanks again for joining me, Dr. Suzanne Murray, Program Director for the Smithsonian's Global Health Program and a board-certified zoo veterinarian at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. Suzanne, thank you again. And from New York City, I'm Anthony Pastore. Thank you all for joining us. We will speak with you soon.
This presentation is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. Neither UBS Financial Services, Inc. nor any of its employees provide tax or legal advice. You should consult with your personal tax or legal advisor regarding your personal circumstances. In providing wealth management services to clients, we offer both investment advisory and brokerage services, which are separate and distinct and differ in material ways. For information, including the different laws and contracts that govern, visit ubs.com/workingwithus. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA, SIPC.